It's Friday, July 9th, and those extra lines on your vaccination card, they're there for a reason. We start here. Pfizer becomes the first vaccine maker to say you should get a COVID booster shot.
What they're saying is essentially just three might be better.
We're not talking the distant future. We're potentially talking about this year. We'll break down what the new vaccination effort could look like. Let the games begin, with or without a national emergency.
No spectators will be able to go into any of these.
After months of assurances, Japan sounds new alarms with Olympic athletes on the way. And a plot twist in Haiti, two Americans are among those arrested for an assassination.
Some people have been harassed because of their complexion.
Tensions are high in the streets. We will put you there on the ground. From ABC News, this is Start Here. I'm Brad Milkey. When the FDA made Pfizer and Moderna, the first two COVID vaccines available to Americans, there was a single clear definition as to what fully vaccinated means. You gotta get two shots, then 2 weeks later, you're vaxxed.
New data showing Johnson & Johnson's one-shot vaccine may be 100% effective at preventing hospitalization and death.
Then Johnson & Johnson came along. Suddenly, some Americans could be done after just one shot.
The world is understandably worried about the Delta virus variant.
Then we started learning about variants, these new versions of COVID born out of mutations as it gets transmitted from one person to another.
But studies showed, as I've showed you on the previous four or five slides, that the vaccines indeed are effective against it.
Thus far, these vaccines have worked against all the variants. But the variants themselves heighten the stakes of what was already being predicted by a lot of scientists, that someday soon, despite all the hoopla of getting vaccinated these last several months, you might someday need another shot, a booster shot. Yesterday, Pfizer became the first vaccine maker to come out and say, yes, you probably will need a booster shot, and yes, you're going to need it soon. Let's go to ABC's Anne Flaherty, who's been covering the vaccine rollout. And Anne, can I just ask you a health question first, especially as someone who got the Pfizer vaccine, by the way? Does this vaccine work? Like, am I still protected with the two doses I have?
It works, and it works incredibly well. We haven't seen this new data that Pfizer says that it has. They're even saying that two shots of their vaccine is good and that you are protected. What they're saying is essentially just three might be better. So the next stop is they are going to go to the FDA and they're going to lay out this data and ask for authorization for a third shot for 6 to 12 months.
I think we will almost certainly require a booster sometime within a year or so after getting the primary.
So looking at the idea of a booster, I mean, this is something that health officials have been talking about for a long time, and it's something that everybody has been expecting is going to probably happen eventually.
Although we expected the Delta variant to become the dominant strain in the United States, this rapid rise is troubling.
And the reason why it seems like it's coming up now is because of the Delta variant and other variants that are emerging throughout the globe. So this is a problem that they want to address. What I do think is interesting is that Pfizer is not talking about a different vaccine to address these variants. They're just talking about a third booster of the same cocktail. It's essentially the same vaccine that they would give you to try to boost immunity. So then last night, Brad, the FDA and the CDC put out a joint statement making clear that Americans who've been fully vaccinated do not need a booster shot at this time. They said virtually all COVID hospitalizations and deaths are people who are not vaccinated. So this is clearly a response to the Pfizer announcement.
Certainly the individuals who would be most at risk and the individuals who mount the lowest immune responses will be the ones who should get booster shots first.
And I do think it's possible that at some point the FDA is going to look at this data and say, you know, yes, a booster is a good option, particularly for older people. They might be looking at people in nursing homes or who are medically vulnerable.
For example, it's already been shown that immunocompromised individuals often do not generate high levels of immunity after the standard vaccine regimens.
But I think if you're younger and without underlying medical conditions, you know, they have already made it very clear that this is not a concern right now.
And let's talk about then how it would work, the logistics, because like the first Pfizer shots, like you said, were to medical professionals and then older people. That started back in December, right? Moderna just a couple weeks later. They're very similar vaccines. But so we're already 6 months out from those initial doses, right? When would people start getting boosters?
Right. I mean, you've got to be wondering about this. Some people who are working in the healthcare field, for example, who are those really early recipients of the vaccine, are going to want to know what Pfizer has. But the FDA has to look at all this data and they're going to make a recommendation. Then the CDC is going to look at this and say, okay, so who do we recommend this for? Is this for the healthcare workers who are at most at risk? Is this for the elderly and people in nursing homes? I suspect that's probably what they will say. And also, you know, keep in mind, we have millions of doses on hand that we haven't been able to distribute yet. So I don't think we're going to quite see the scramble that we saw with these initial rollout.
Well, and I do think it brings up the question of how many doses, how many times people are willing to do this, right? Because it's been hard enough to get people to get a first shot and then their second shot, right? We've seen a drop off just between those. And for people who still aren't vaccinated at all, and you've actually been pressing the Biden administration on what the next plan really is. They keep saying we're gonna keep approaching Americans about getting vaccinated, but you've been asking them, okay, like how?
Right. Well, Biden has been talking for weeks about these local trusted messengers, is what he calls them. These are local doctors, community organizers, pastors and priests who would be enlisted to go out into the community and spread the word to answer people's questions on the vaccine.
We're stepping up our preparations to respond to the outbreaks we're going to see among the unvaccinated.
He's also at the same time called for these surge teams that the White House would send to states that are facing outbreaks.
Now we need to go to community by community, neighborhood by neighborhood, and oftentimes door to door, literally knocking on doors to get help to the remaining people protected from the virus.
And these would be like epidemiologists from the CDC that would help you track an outbreak with genetic sequencing.
Dan Crenshaw, among many conservatives, not very happy with this. He writes the following. How about don't knock on my door? You're not my parents. You're the government. Make the vaccine available and let the people be free to choose.
Here's somehow it was really interesting because this week it sort of got so conflated. And the GOP kept saying, some lawmakers and conservative pundits were out there saying, well, this means that Biden is going to be, the federal government is going to be knocking at my door, asking my vaccination status. And that actually isn't the case.
Wait,
it's not
because Biden literally, Biden used the phrase door to door, right?
He did, but he wasn't talking about the federal government. And this is something that I've actually confirmed with multiple people and multiple agencies is that this isn't the federal government. This isn't a federal agent knocking at your door. This is like, you know, the local pharmacist going door to door, trying to meet people where they are and have private conversations with them to say like, look, if you've got questions about this vaccine, I'm here and I care about you and I want to talk to you.
In Southwest Missouri, just 6% of ICU beds are available. Teams inside Mercy Hospital are treating patients who are younger and sicker and mostly unvaccinated.
Meanwhile, Missouri's Governor Mike Parson didn't waste any time turning down the help this morning.
So in Missouri, we heard the governor say that he won't allow federal agents to come knocking on doors in his state.
Jeff, if you could respond to the Missouri governor's.
Well, I asked the White House coordinator for COVID, Jeff Zients, you know, what gives that? How do you respond to that?
For those individuals, organizations that are feeding misinformation and trying to mischaracterize this type of trusted messenger work, I believe you are doing a disservice to the country and to the doctors, the faith.
And he snapped back and accused critics of misinformation and he said it was a disservice to the country.
Yeah, a lot of misinformation, a lot of purposeful disinformation out there as well. And now you wonder how people will be reacting as they hear that first and second dose might not be their last either. Ann Flaherty, thank you so much for the information. Really helpful.
Thanks, Brad.
Next up on Start Here, Japan just declared a COVID emergency, but 10,000 athletes are on the way anyway. We're back in a bit.
Hey, I'm Andy Mitchell, a New York Times bestselling author.
And I'm Sabrina Kohlberg, a morning television producer. We're moms of toddlers and best friends of 20 years.
And we both love to talk about being parents, yes, but also pop culture.
So we're combining our two interests by talking to celebrities, writers, and fellow scholars of TV and movies.
Cinema, really.
About what we all can learn from the fictional moms we love to watch.
From ABC Audio and Good Morning America, Pop Culture Moms is out now wherever you listen to podcasts.
We've got the exclusive view behind the table. Every day, right after the show, while the topics are still hot, the ladies go deeper into the moments that make the view, the view. The Views Behind the Table podcast. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
If vaccinations define how a country is doing against COVID-19 at this point, well, that's a problem for a country like Japan, which is not just a country with an abysmal vaccination rate at this point, but today also a country that is 2 weeks away from hosting the opening ceremonies of the Olympics.
We are not speculating of whether the games are taking place. We are working on how.
For months, we've been told the Olympics are happening. No one from other countries is allowed to come watch. No one's allowed to cheer, even if they are there, just in case they're carrying the virus. But with all the protocols, authorities said, we should be fine.
We are now faced with the COVID-19, so we have no other choice but to hold the games in a limited way.
Well, yesterday, literally on the same day the head of the International Olympic Committee arrived in Tokyo, the Prime Minister of Japan announced the country is back in a state of emergency that will extend through the games and that the Olympics will be played with zero spectators in the stands. Let's go to ABC's foreign correspondent, James Longman, who's covering the Olympics. He's supposed to be heading to Tokyo soon, at least, James. I think that's the plan at this point. What is happening there?
I mean, it doesn't look good, does it, Brad? They have been worried for months about holding these games, and it seems now, really, it's got to crunch point.
As for Tokyo 2020, a very heavy judgment was made.
Tokyo going under a state of emergency now, but the games still going ahead, just reduced way back from what obviously one would expect from watching an Olympic Games.
The venues in Tokyo will be not including spectators.
A little bit of context here. You know, the Japanese are worried about COVID. It is rising. Their numbers are going up. But they're seeing less than about 1,000 daily cases in Tokyo. It's a city of 14 million people. They've seen something like 15,000 deaths total in a country of over 125 million people. So compared to places like the United States and Britain, where I am,
right,
they've done very, very well.
If we hold the Olympics, there is no doubt variants will enter Japan.
But the Japanese do not have a high tolerance level for this sort of thing.
6,000 Japanese doctors called for the Olympics to be cancelled.
They're angry that the virus in their minds has got out of control. They were doing very, very well, and numbers are going up now.
Adults have not yet all been vaccinated, and vaccinations for children haven't even started.
Fundamentally, though, they just haven't vaccinated enough people. They're watching Delta variants propagate around the world. They want the over 60s vaccinated in Japan as soon as possible. Of course, it's one of the oldest populations on earth.
Right.
So it's about worrying about what could happen next.
But so I hear you saying that the Japanese have just a lower threshold for what means a really bad outbreak than the US or the UK does. I get that. But then they're also hosting the largest sporting event on earth, right?
Yeah.
So should the government, if they're so worried, should the government just cancel these Olympics?
And a large majority of the Japanese people believe they should, or at least postpone them. Fundamentally, though, it all comes down to money. It's understood that it'll cost about $4 billion for the International Olympic Committee if these get cancelled. That's in things like television rights. For the Japanese, though, to cancel them, they would have to shoulder the burden of the entire cost because contractually they've agreed to hold them, and it would cost them something like $17 billion to cancel this. So the reality is that all the economic benefit for Japan is almost already dead anyway. They would get their money from people visiting the country, from people staying in hotels, from people buying things and going to restaurants. None of that is going to happen now. If it was up to just the Japanese, I suspect they probably would want to cancel it, but they can't. And I should add, though, Brad, the critics of this will say that it's all very well for the IOC to demand that this goes on, but fundamentally it's Japan that will have to deal with the potential impact of this on the health of their citizens.
I can't thank everybody enough for going on this journey with me. It's been so special, and I can't believe that this was the last time around.
And I also have to add as well, though, for a lot of athletes,
and I had a serious injury for the last 2 years, so
you know, they really want to compete, and in the career of the average athlete, the Olympics is the pinnacle.
Just pure enjoyment and excitement and visualizing myself on the track.
And for poorer nations who don't have, you know, very wealthy Olympic associations who back their training, they often have to pay their own way.
Kenya flag to our team captain.
And if they don't go now, then they'll never compete in an Olympics. And if they keep postponing it, it'll only just be rich countries being able to compete.
Wow. Okay, so that makes it higher stakes than for everyone. Like, that's why you just feel this insane inertia, this unstoppable momentum that is the Olympic Games. What's that like then, James, as everyone gets ready to go, or people who are there already? What are these games going to be like when the athletes show up or when you show up?
oh my God, Brad, this is what we've all been talking about. I'm meant to be going there and I'm worried about what it's going to be like when I arrive, right. Not just the athletes. I mean, look, already they've had some athletes arriving in the country. Some of them have had Delta, which has meant that they've had to, you know, further increase checks at the airport. Just to give you an idea of what happens when I go, I have to be tested every day for 3 days before departure. I'm then tested at the airport. I then have to go to my hotel directly and spend 3 days in total isolation. I'm then tested every 4 days after that, and nobody, athletes, journalists, technicians, officials, nobody is allowed to leave the Olympic bubble and go into Tokyo at any point for the first 14 days. And also, I should add that the athletes themselves, after they've competed, they're given 48 hours to leave the country. So I don't know how much fun this is going to be, if I'm honest, Brad. No spectators will be able to go into any of these stadia. I, though, will be able to go in, so that might be quite special. But, you know, this is going to be a television event, let's face it.
Right. And in a world now where we've seen, what, two baseball seasons, two hockey seasons, two basketball seasons, the Olympics were pushed back a year, we're going to see empty stadiums throughout Tokyo. James Longman, on his way, we hope. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Brett.
When authorities in Haiti announced that President Jovenel Moïse had been assassinated, they did give a few details. They said this was not some lone gunman in the street. Instead, a heavily armed group that somehow broke into the president's closely guarded compound.
We are gathering information, and we know some of them are still in the country.
Well, yesterday, authorities offered some of their first information about the arrests they have made since.
Authorities say they killed four people connected to the assassination in a gun battle.
First, they said they raided a house containing several suspects, and what followed was a wild shootout. Multiple suspects were killed, four more were arrested, then more suspects were brought in throughout the day. Eventually, 17 of them were hauled in front of cameras. And in a development that could have far-reaching implications for what happens next in Haiti, authorities say nearly all of these men are foreigners. More than a dozen of them are allegedly from Colombia, and in a bizarre twist, two of them are American citizens, including a 35-year-old Haitian-American man named James Solange. And with that, let's take you to Haiti right now. Jacques Richard Miguel is working for ABC just outside of Port-au-Prince. And Jacques Richard, I know you said you had been without electricity since they declared this, they're calling it a state of siege. What is it like in the streets where you are right now?
The streets are basically deserted. Stores are closed. Supermarkets are closed. Businesses are not functioning normally. Here and there, you find a couple of motorcycle guys going up and down, and that's it. I mean, everybody's on alert or waiting for things to fall back into place, waiting for the stores to reopen, because for the past 2 days, there have been no activities, no normalcy.
We now have breaking news abroad. The president of Haiti has been assassinated by unknown assailants.
It happened early in the morning, so most people were asleep because there was a football game that evening, and most people were asleep and found out when they woke up.
Haitian people, stay calm as everything is under control.
It was quite a shock, and everybody was afraid and saying, don't go out. Be careful. Don't go outside. The president was killed, you know. Seems like some mercenaries killed him.
Most of them were speaking Spanish, some were speaking English.
They were speaking Spanish and they presented themselves as DEA agents.
Some Spanish people killed him, some Spanish-speaking people and English-speaking people and all kinds of... I mean, there was a lot of confusion as to who actually killed him.
Right.
And the main thing was that nobody understood how he could be killed in his own residence with all those bodyguards.
Right.
That's what was the real shock was, okay, so how many bodyguards were killed? And everybody said, no, none. And it was like, wow, that's weird.
And this is not like a president who walks around without bodyguards. Like, this is somebody who has people.
No, he has a cortege of 10 to 15 vehicles. When they go through town, it's a show. And I'm sure at his residence, it's a lot of security there. So it doesn't make sense. You know, there's something not quite clear in this picture.
Well, and I'm wondering what the reaction was when authorities came out yesterday and gave some more information about people. For example, they said two of these assailants, these attackers, they didn't say what exactly they are suspected to have done, but they said two of them are American citizens, Haitian descent, American citizens. You talked earlier about how, you know, they might have been heard speaking Spanish or even English, and that seems important in a country that has been kind of hijacked at times by outside interest around the Western Hemisphere. So there's kind of this distrust of foreigners, perhaps, that clearly being escalated in a moment like this. What is the reaction from people around town as far as who is being held responsible for this?
There are a lot of people that are upset that people can come from the outside and manage to get that close to a president. I mean, someone of such high importance, and assassinate him and leave so easily. And there are a lot of people who are under the impression that these were people that were hired. These were mercenaries and that were hired by someone here to perform this barbarous act. That's basically the thing. Right now, there's an atmosphere of anti-foreigner or anti-blanc that is going around.
What was the next thing you said? Anti-what?
Is anti-white. I mean, the people that killed them, whether they're Spanish or Latino or whatever, they call them blanc in Haiti.
Hmm.
So it's an anti-blanc atmosphere. Hmm. And supposedly in that area where they supposedly captured these people, they are supposedly still searching for some people.
Hmm.
So it's some people have been harassed because of their complexion. Because, oh, there's one. Or where did he come from? Or what is that person doing here? What is his, you know, do you have identity on you? What do you do? Are you one of the mercenaries? That type of thing that's going on right now.
Right. We actually heard that two of the people they arrested were brought to them essentially by a mob, that a mob of people gathered around some people, brought them to the police. And the police said, okay, I guess we'll take these people off your hands, but please stay calm in the meantime.
Yes, because if they didn't take these people off their hands, they would have probably been, you know, lynched or ripped to pieces. Basically, the population is so easily influenced by information or misinformation that they basically are looking for anybody who looks like a Mexican or a Colombian or Venezuelan. They accuse all types of nationalities to be involved in this act. So the population, not knowing, says, oh, wait, there's one. And it's not too far from Jovenel's house, so let's grab him.
Hmm.
You know, and it could be a Cuban doctor, it could be anybody. So right now the situation is a bit not quite clear and kind of dangerous for people of foreign descent. And basically, if you're strolling around and you don't know, you have nobody to vouch for you, you can just be grabbed and said, here's one, I got one, there's one living in that apartment over there, let's go get him.
Outside a local police station, Haitians burning tires and pickup trucks, demanding justice.
Yeah, everybody's nervous and on edge because they don't know what's going to happen next. I mean, this is like something happens. I mean, this is a major event, and they don't know what the fallout will be from this.
Yeah, the police actually said they wanted to see some of these suspects' cars as evidence. Then they figured out that several of the cars had already been torched by angry crowds of people. So, Jacques Richard-Miguel, working for ABC just outside of Port-au-Prince, thanks so much, and stay safe.
Thank you for your time, and look forward to seeing you.
Okay, we're going to step away again real quick. When we come back, it shouldn't take a genius to fix everything. One last thing is next.
The first ever criminal trial of a former president is underway in Manhattan. It's one of potentially four trials facing former President Trump as he makes his third bid for the White House. What do voters think about his culpability, and would a guilty verdict make a difference in the election? I'm Galen Druk, and every Monday and Thursday on the 538 Politics podcast, we break down the latest news from the campaign trail. We sort through the noise and zoom in on what really matters, using data and research as we go. That's 538 Politics every Monday and Thursday, wherever you get your podcasts.
And one last thing. Apple users will often tell you it feels like the only person who can fix their iPhone is someone from the Apple Store. And the next thing they'll tell you is that doesn't feel like an accident. Well, this week, the co-founder of Apple, Steve Wozniak, issued a video saying anyone should get to tinker with something they bought as much as they want.
We wouldn't have had an Apple had I not grown up in a very open technology world, an open electronics world.
Which is something, considering the company he started and no longer controls, is famously reticent to give out diagrams or even spare parts for their products. It's also one of the fiercest opponents of a movement called the Right to Repair.
Look at the Apple II. It's shipped with full schematics, designs and software source listings, you know.
See, throughout the history of owning stuff, if something breaks, generally you can try to fix it yourself, or at least take it to a neighborhood repair guy who knows how to. Your car, your air conditioner, your vacuum. But what if your vacuum manufacturer made it harder to make these small fixes and said, hey, you can pay us to take a hack at it or just buy a new vacuum?
My John Deere tractor here is having some issues that's causing it to shut down.
A few years ago, John Deere infuriated American farmers by saying from now on, if you want to make adjustments to its new line of tractors, you had to get an authorized John Deere person to do it.
Some of these people have spent $700,000-$800,000 for that piece of equipment. And really, they find out they're just kind of leasing it, renting it. It's not theirs because they don't have the right to repair.
Suddenly, they found themselves joining with open source tech advocates. Fast forward, and as soon as today, President Biden is preparing to issue an executive order that will give farmers and perhaps other industries the right to repair stuff however they like. Manufacturers say they've always been doing this out of the concern for customer safety. John Deere says, hey, we got to comply with emissions laws. Customers say all you're doing is ensuring more products end up in landfills. How is that green? And Steve Wozniak says you're preventing the next Woz from building something new.
Hey, is it your computer or is it some company's computer?
The rule in America, once farmers team up against you, you're done. And now that you mention it, every episode of Start Here is effectively crowdsourced from the following people. Start Here is produced by David Rind, Kelly Therese, Josh Cohan, Ariel Chester, Lewis Millman, Tara Gimbel, David Toledo, Madeline Wood, and Lauren Efron. Thanks to Liz Alessi, Eric Johnson, Lakia Brown, John Newman, Elizabeth Russo, and Stacia Deshishku. Special thanks this week to Hakyung Kate Lee, Kirit Radia, Chris Berry, Sasha Borodovsky, and welcome to the team Brenda Salinas-Baker. I'm Brad Milkey. See you Monday.